You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. Whole Foods Market is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and the Department of Transportation's Summer Streets, a three-day series of events dedicated to healthy, active living on the car-free streets of New York City. Join us at the Whole Foods Market City Picnic Area on 24th Street and Park Avenue the first three Saturdays in August. Find more information at the DOT's website, keyword Summer Streets.
Hey, and welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Can you smell this? I'm asking you, the listeners, can you smell this? Because today we have on a now prolific author, Molly Birnbaum, who just wrote Season of Taste, a book about smell, about the loss of smell, regaining smell, and everything in between. Thank you for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah. We met a couple years ago when you were actually doing an article, I think, about female chefs.
Yeah, I was when I was a graduate student.
Yeah,
Years ago.
And I remember all the questions about, like, Barbara Lynch from Boston, who I got to spend years with in the kitchen. And at that point, I think you did mention that you didn't have, or at one point didn't have, a sense of smell. And I kind of glossed over that fact. I think we discussed it very briefly. But now it's come to, you know, the forefront. It's come bound. It's in a book.
It has.
Which I just read over the weekend and is heart-wrenchingly awesome.
And
but, like, aspirational and exciting all at the same time. But let's start from the beginning.
Sure.
How did you lose your sense of smell?
Well, it was the summer of 2005. I had just graduated from college. I was in love with food and cooking. I wanted nothing more than to be a chef. So I was working at the very bottom of the chain of a restaurant in Boston as a dishwasher.
Yeah, which place?
It was Craigie Street Bistro, now Craigie on Main,
yeah.
Working for Chef Tony Maz. And I had aspirations to go to culinary school, which I was set to do maybe 5 months later. But first I was going to work in this restaurant.
Yeah.
And I started from the very bottom, doing dishes, chopping garlic, the whole nine yards. But the very end of August of that summer, I went for a jog in the morning and I was hit by a car.
Yeah.
And in that accident, I tore the tendons in my left knee, I broke my pelvis, and I fractured my skull.
Yeah.
I would later learn that in the impact of that head fracture, my brain bounced in my skull, in effect severing the olfactory neurons, which run from the nose to the brain. And so in an instant, I lost my sense of smell.
Do you remember the smell of the accident? I mean,
like, I don't remember a thing about the accident. That day, pretty much the next 2 weeks, are a blur. I have small little memories, but nothing concrete. And it was weeks after that when I realized that I couldn't smell. I was first to, you know, racked with pain and depression and not really understanding what was going on. But it was one day when my stepmother had baked an apple crisp. And I think there were a bunch of people in the room, my family, and everyone was oohing and aahing over the smell of this apple crisp, which is something she made all the time and I loved. And the smell reminded me of fall. And, you know, it was a very happy thing, but I could not smell a thing. And I realized, especially after she held it under my nose and I breathed in and there was nothing, that there was something very wrong.
What is the term for losing a sense of smell?
Anosmia is the term for those who cannot smell, or the condition for those who cannot smell.
And, I mean, it can happen in so many different ways, from accidents to, you know, disease to, I mean, genetically not having
Right.
Receptors.
Some people are born without a sense of smell, but in terms of losing it, it's generally for three reasons, either a sinus disease or upper respiratory infection. Just a common cold can cause you to lose your sense of smell.
Yeah.
Or a head injury.
I had the, I think, other two as a child for years, and had a deviated septum that I had fixed when I think it was 15. And I don't think I smelled up until then, really. I mean, little bits here and there. And as you can see by my nose, it was not plastic surgery, because they never fixed the bumps and the crooks that are there. But yeah, I think it wasn't until 15 that I could actually start playing sports, because I could breathe through my nose. And you don't realize how much of a role, these two little holes in your face actually.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, actually make. Loss of smell. I think to understand that too, you have to understand how the nose works. And I mean, there's tons and tons of scientific information and season to taste, but can you give us the most basic explanation of how we smell?
Well, basically, smell molecules, which come from, roasting chicken or veal stock simmering on the stove, enter your nose, and on the top reaches of your nasal cavity, they encounter olfactory receptors, which there are many theories as to how exactly they work, but in essence, they pick up these smell molecules, and through the olfactory neurons, which do run from your nose to your brain, send patterns or signals. Some smells have hundreds of different signals being sent through neurons up to the brain. And like reading sheet music or, the HTML coding of a website, your brain responds to those patterns and says, oh, veal stock. Oh, roasting chicken. It's like, I always think of it like reading music in the brain.
Yeah. So it's kind of rote. It's learned.
It's learned. It's been shown that we are not born with many scents that we automatically love or hate. It's all through experience and context that we grow to first understand what it is that we're smelling, and then also have an opinion about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are no innate smells that are automatically bad, like, dog poop, or, automatically good, like apple pie.
Well, I mean, it's hard to say, because we can't really ask a newborn what they're thinking about the smell, but
they may love the smell of dog poop.
Right. Well, there have been studies to show that very small babies are not repulsed by the smell of poop. So it's not clear.
Yeah. Excellent. Talking about smell and how big a part it plays of your senses, had you ever gone before without sight or feel, or, I mean, have you ever not had one of your senses functioning?
I never have before this. I think growing up, of course, I had colds in which I couldn't smell, and that was always something that made me think, oh, food tastes like nothing, this is no fun, but I never really put it in context.
Yeah, so I mean, how did you think to start regaining your sense of smell, or how did you adapt to not having smell at that point?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the beginning, when I couldn't smell anything, and I was still in love with food and cooking, I taught myself to cook with my other senses. So once I recovered enough to actually function well in the kitchen, I spent a lot of time thinking about sight and about sound. I mean, the look of food on a plate, the sound of butter melting in a pan, and texture and temperature and all these other cues for flavor, which I never gave that much thought to. And so when I was cooking with those in mind, I found that I could really enjoy both cooking and eating in a way that I never really could before.
Yeah, were you sated by cookbooks then? Because they have all those, referential things aesthetically and talk about the tactile, but there aren't any like scratch and sniff cookbooks, so you don't know, what you're looking for smell-wise.
Right, exactly. And I stuck to very rote recipes. I didn't experiment at all, because I found when I did try and cook without measurements already in place, my cooking was mediocre at best.
Yeah. And do you remember the first thing that you cooked after the accident? And I mean, how far from the accident was that?
Well, it wasn't that far, actually. I remember baking while on crutches in my mother's kitchen, which was it was interesting.
Yeah.
But I started with baking, actually, because I figured, because baking is all about measurement and science and temperature and time, that you need recipes, most people do, to bake. I figured that I could do that better than cooking savory.
Just have a control.
Have a control. Given, yeah. So I think one of the first things I made were chocolate cookies.
Yeah.
And I put a little bit of cayenne pepper in them because I ate so much spicy food during this time because I could feel the heat and the tingle from the nerves in my mouth, which I really liked. And these cookies were not fabulous, but they were fine.
Excellent. Feeling heat. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how did you eat with a sense of smell? I mean, they were more. It was more sensational.
Yeah, without a sense of smell, it was much more sensational. I put Tabasco sauce on everything for a while because it made my lips burn, and I liked that feeling because it was feeling something.
Yeah. So, I mean, of like the four, well, we'll consider umami too.
Mm-hmm.
Which of the ones were you most looking towards trying to eat when you didn't have a smell? I mean, were you looking for just heat, or were you looking for bitter, salty, sweet?
Yeah, no, well, heat was one thing, but also I liked salty food. I liked potato chips and pretzels, you know, that crunch with the salt, you know, something that kind of hits you over the head. I also really liked sweet, which I still like today, but
yeah.
I ate a lot of ice cream then because I really liked the texture, the smooth texture of ice cream, and especially when it had things in it for that contrasting textural crunch.
Yeah, well, you also had temperature too.
And which, temperature, yeah.
So the great part of the book was with Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's.
That was great. Yeah, no, I talked to Ben Cohen, who's one of the two founders of Ben & Jerry's, and he has a very diminished sense of smell, which makes total sense because our ice cream has so much texture to it.
Yeah, I mean, everyone just thought it was some hippies in Vermont throwing everything they had. But, you know, prior to that, I bet you not a lot of ice creams had chunks of, you know, chocolate covered this and swirls of that. So,
and they
do
chunks very well.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So addictive. So aside from ice cream, what were you craving at that point?
Well, I don't think that I really craved anything at that point. It was difficult for me to eat in the beginning when I couldn't smell anything. And it was, I forced myself to eat, of course, and I found enjoyment eventually. But I've found in talking to people who can't smell that our cues for eating are a little bit off. It's difficult to tell when you're full, when you're satiated. And I too found that it was difficult to eat or to crave or to feel like I was done in a way that I had before.
That's interesting you say cues for eating. Do you think there's a difference culturally too on, you know, how people or why people eat? And do you think, you know, meeting a nosmiacs, is that right?
A
nosmiacs?
It's hard to say you actually say it.
Those without smell from different cultures,
right.
how it would affect their eating habits.
I mean, I haven't met a whole lot of people not from America who cannot smell, a few here and there, but I would imagine that it affects people differently because we all eat differently in different cultures and we have different dishes and smells and cues and times and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So I would imagine too. It's an interesting question.
So when did this accident happen again? How many years ago?
It's 6 years ago. It was in 2005.
What was the first smell that you regained?
It was rosemary.
Yeah.
It was fabulous. It was only 3 months after the accident.
Yeah.
So it was relatively soon, but I was helping my mother cook dinner and I was chopping the fresh herb, rosemary, and it just hit me over the head suddenly. Like a light in the dark. It was really phenomenal.
Yeah, and that was the one and only smell you were able to
Right.
You
know, it was just
recognize.
That by itself. Right then. And then when I did begin to regain my sense of smell, it was often one scent at a time, but more and more as time went on.
Yeah. Do you have a list of what you regained when?
Well, I know the first couple, which was rosemary and then chocolate came back. And I remember smelling the fruity red to a glass of red wine.
Yeah.
Later there were cucumbers, which I had never thought about the smell of cucumbers before, but then it was just so strong. It could, you know, infiltrate a whole room with the smell of cucumbers. So I loved eating cucumbers.
Yeah. Did you ever make a meal of rosemary, chocolate, cucumbers, and red wine?
I should have, but I don't think I ever did.
You know, it was great too. Is wine just felt like this thing that you had to do. I mean, it was a celebratory thing priorly, and now you were just drinking it almost for its tannins.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like you were forcing yourself to eat and drink certain things just because of a cultural context?
For sure. I mean, most of the time, eating for me is with other people. And one of the things that I love most about food and cooking is how it brings people together over the table. So even when I couldn't fully taste wine, I still enjoyed drinking it because we were all having fun together. And,
yeah,
you know, reminded me of my past and, you know, all sorts of things I've done. So food for me has always had a larger context, which is how it made it easier to eat when I couldn't smell.
Yeah. So speaking of context, too, in reading through the book, a lot of the difficulty you had was not only smelling, but recognizing smells once you got that sense back. Could you, think of something from your childhood, like an apple pie baking, and recall that smell? Or were you having troubles actually recognizing things because you didn't have a reference point?
Well, it was difficult. When I actually did regain my ability to smell everything around me, I had a lot of trouble recognizing smells. And in part, I think that's because my nose was out of practice. In part, I think it's because maybe my sense of smell returned a little bit differently than it was before. But it's so difficult to remember smells when you don't have the thing that smells right in front of you. Or
yeah,
for me, it's very difficult to label. And I mean, on that note, closing your eyes now and imagining the sense of apple pie, it's almost impossible to do. It's not like you can close your eyes and see an apple pie. You can visualize it, but you can't visualize, I suppose, smell in the same way.
Well, I mean, when I was reading your book, I could.
Really?
Yeah, but then I didn't realize that I was reading it in a restaurant and they had pie on there. I'm like, I'm really good at this. So
that would have been great if they were
true. Yeah, but I mean, did it actually change your perception of certain flavors? Did apple pie smell like rosemary? Did rosemary smell like chocolate?
Most things smell like I remember them. And I mean, memory is fallible, so maybe it's a little bit different, but they are so familiar when I see what's in front of me that I feel like that's the same. A couple things were a little bit different. For example, skunk.
Yeah.
Before the accident, I didn't like the smell of skunk.
I love the smell of skunk.
See, yeah, people do.
And gasoline, too. I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now I love the smell of skunk.
Yeah.
The first time I smelled skunk, I thought it smelled like biscotti. I just, like, I loved it.
Yeah.
And maybe we learn to dislike or like that smell when we're very young, and that's why I didn't like it. And then somehow that association was wiped clean when I regained my sense of smell. But now it's great.
Okay, so just a warning for anyone that ever tries to eat Molly's biscotti. May have a little skunk to it. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Molly Birnbaum on the food scene.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Burning Down the House. Architecture is the laser focus of Burning Down the House, a weekly discourse on all things built, destroyed, admired, and despised. Each week, Curtis B. Wayne, your host, invites a posse of authors, critics, builders, designers, and other architecture fiends to reflect on various topics related to perhaps the most functional of all art forms. Again, that's every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with author Molly Birnbaum, Season to Taste, a book about the journey of losing the sense of smell and regaining. Do you like that preface, author,
Molly? I love it.
Yeah. A four-year project, you were telling me.
From very beginning of reporting and writing a proposal for this book to end, it's been about 4 years.
Why did you feel you had to put it into book form?
Well, when I lost my sense of smell, doctors didn't really know what was going to happen, and they couldn't really explain to me what was going on in my own body. And smell was so important to me in terms of taste and flavor that I felt completely derailed without it.
Yeah.
And the only way that I felt I could really move on was to understand. And whereas I wanted that to be a very simple thing of just talking to a few people and getting some answers, it turns out that smell has lots of mysteries.
Yeah.
And I just got sucked into this journey in order to understand what was going on.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing, the cast of people that are in this book, you know, from Oliver Sacks, the physician, neurologist, author, to, you know, a flavorist, which we'll talk about what that is later, to a perfume maker and the Perfume Academy. How little these people knew about smell in, you know, the larger scope of it as, you know, one of your senses.
Right.
That how, you know, there's such a lack of exploration in it.
There are a lot of questions that are unanswered about the sense of smell.
So who was the first authority that you approached? Or non-authority for that matter.
Right. Yeah. Well, the first authority that I really approached was Oliver Sacks. I was slowly gaining back my sense of smell at this point, which made me only feel more frustrated by my lack of knowledge, because each smell that came back came with memory and emotion and just a whole host of things. And I really wanted to understand, you know, what was going on, would I ever totally recover, and what would it mean if I did not. So I had read one of Dr. Sacks's articles in the New Yorker, I think, you know, how he explores the aberrations of the human body and makes it all make sense, and sometimes it has a happy ending, and I thought that maybe he could do the same thing for me.
Yeah, Awakening says both.
Yeah, both. Some good, some bad, but understanding in any case.
Yeah.
So I wrote him a letter, and I explained what was happening to me, what had happened to me, and I asked if he had any thoughts or leads as to explore more. And a generous man that he is, he invited me to come and speak with him. And when I went to meet with him for the first time, I really honestly expected him to just explain it all to
me. This is it, yeah.
Like, light bulb moment. Okay, now I can move on. This is great.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, it's impossible for anything, and impossible even for Dr. Sacks. But he did talk with me about what it means to explore the mysteries of science, of medicine, of our bodies, and how it relates to not only memory and emotion, but our personalities and our sense of self. So it really, you know, it drove me to move on.
So he gave you the foundation and the language to then proceed forwards. And didn't he also give you a sofa rock, or...
he had these two rocks in his office. One was purple. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And the other one was yellow, and it was sulfur. And he had me smell each rock to see if I could smell it. And the first time I met with him, I couldn't smell the sulfur, which has a very potent scent.
Raw eggs. Farts.
Yeah. Volcanic things.
Yeah.
Not a good smell.
Yeah.
But his eyesight was failing at the time, so he liked to look at those rocks to tell the difference in color.
Yeah. I mean, not that it was felicitous per se, but how parallel to meet someone who also was losing a sense.
Right.
You know, his sight.
Right.
It's degrading. So did you feel akin in that sense to him?
I did. And it really helped me to put my own loss in a greater context. I mean, something that losing your sense of smell, as many people have told me, would be the first sense they would lose if they could pick any sense to lose. And I was totally lucky to recover on other levels. And seeing someone else going through something that was much more physically present and damaging was humbling and helpful.
Yeah. And then from Oliver, you met I think Richard Doty was next.
Right. I met him. He's a doctor at the Taste and Smell Center at the University of Pennsylvania.
Did you even know such a center existed prior?
Well, I had gone to one center like this when I was without any smells to get myself tested. But I did not know the mechanics of a place like this until I went myself as a reporter.
Yeah. And what happened there? Testing?
Well, they have people who can't smell or have distortions of smell or less smell than normal often come in to have themselves tested at this clinic, which is an all-day affair. It's a battery of tests in terms of your taste and your smell, your cognition. And at the end, you do scratch and sniff, like a whole nine yards. And at the end, they give you a summary of what your abilities or lack of abilities are and give you suggestions as to what to do in the future.
Yeah, what were your abilities and lack thereof?
Well, the first time I went, that was the first time I smelled chocolate. So it was a very happy experience for me, even though I couldn't smell anything else. And the doctors there told me that it's possible to recover, but I should not get my hopes up.
Yeah.
But when I was
that a lot, didn't you?
I got that a lot. That's why I kept on moving forward.
But
seeing other people who had lost their sense of smell, there's not a lot of hope, actually. So I'm incredibly lucky that I regained mine.
Yeah. And from there, met people who actually produce smells, like Christopher, how do you say, La Dumiel?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, he's a perfumer. He was with IFF when I met him. He's no longer. But he makes just wildly creative, intense perfumes.
Yeah. Any specific perfumes that people would know?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. Recently, he's been doing a few more creative things. Like, I went to an opera that he produced that had smells instead of voices.
Yeah, yeah.
Which brought smell into a whole new category for me.
That whole synesthesia.
Right, right. Combining all of our senses.
Yeah, which I'm assuming you had because you were lacking one, so you had to make up, with the rest.
I don't know if I had it, but I certainly concentrated on it so much that I think I produced it.
So from perfumers, you also met a flavorist.
And I did.
Explain what a flavorist is and, who you actually met and how you explored that.
Sure. I met a woman named Elaine Kelman Grossinger, and she is a flavor chemist at Citramax in New Jersey. And this is a company that makes flavors for food. And I had always known that flavor is added to food, natural or unnatural, all sorts of chemical concoctions that create the taste of soft drinks or, fruit roll-ups or all sorts of different things that we eat on an almost day-to-day level for many people in America. And she, again, very generously invited me into her flavor lab so I could see how they actually make these flavors, which is done with chemicals and mixed in with recipes and somewhat like a perfumer, mixing all sorts of different individual smells for a larger whole. But also like a chef, because you're taking all of these different tastes and turning them into a larger, more complex meal. But it was very eye-opening to see how they actually do this.
Yeah. What were some of your favorite flavors or smells?
Well, they were interesting. That was one experience in which I had a very hard time recognizing what I was smelling, because when you get down on such a minute level of tastes, or smells, because they often smell before they taste anything there. Often they were unfamiliar. I mean, some interesting ones were benzaldehyde, which smells like cherries and a little bit like almonds. Cis-3-hexanol or hexanol, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, it smells like fresh cut grass. And they use that in flavors for food that we eat. And I had never thought of all of these strange things that go into the food that we eat.
So when you do wine pairing notes now, you're like, it's a little bit of cis-3-hexanol in it.
Oh yeah, I wish. I wish I could pick stuff out like that.
Yeah. I mean, I find the flavor is completely fascinating that there are these engineered flavors, such as in, perfumes.
Mm-hmm.
But you went even further and went to France to study at a perfume academy.
I did.
Yeah. Where was it?
It was in Grasse in the south of France. I did 2 weeks at a perfume school boot camp in which we smelled raw perfume materials for 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And learned to apply labels and words and how to mix them. And it was by no means was I a perfumer when I left there, but I got a very interesting look at what it's like to smell without any context and really learn how to memorize scent by applying labels and memories and visual scenes and, you know, sounds. So it was very synesthetic, I suppose. It was very different than anything I've ever done before.
But, I mean, you weren't just dealing with synthetics at that point.
No.
I mean, there were natural smells as well.
Natural and synthetics.
Yeah.
We smelled hundreds of smells and tested ourselves on them over and over again.
What were some of the base natural smells that you were first privy to?
Oh, I'm trying to remember. There was lavender, I remember, and rose, and I think galbanum, and just all sorts of smells that were familiar yet not, and had poetic names, and came in these clear little bottles, and if you opened one for too long, it would fill the entire room with a smell so strong.
Yeah, but I mean, these were like singular entities, so these smells almost felt autonomous.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember there was a point in the book where someone was making you smell something and you couldn't really pick it out. And then there was mint, and then rose.
I think geranium is one that had all sorts of little tiny pinpricks of smell as part of it. And when you concentrate that hard on a smell, you can pick out these tiny nuances. And that really comes from training and from practice and just smelling it over and over again. And when you do that, it's so exciting when you can get to that point of recognizing it based on a little tiny nuance.
Yeah. I mean, just smelling wine for the first time,
mm-hmm.
you get all that tannin and you're like, oh, I smell this. And all you're really smelling
right.
is tannin.
Right. It's just like wine.
Yeah.
And with practice, you can pick out all of those tiny little things that are there that really, when you understand it, make it that much more impressive and delicious.
Well, I mean, let's talk about building a smell, because, you know, it's not like you just put mint and put rose and you have rose geranium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how small, how minute are these molecules, and how many molecules make up a smell?
Well, it can be anywhere from 20 to hundreds to make up one smell in terms of actual molecules. In terms of perfume, each raw material isn't a singular molecule, but comes from a singular place. And so when you mix together complex perfumes, Chanel No. 9, you're dealing with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of olfactory molecules coming in. It's very complex.
Yeah. Screw smell. You've gotten most of it back.
I have.
Yeah, and you're slowly regaining. So you get to appreciate all this now.
I do.
But you also got to eat this kind of amazingly poetic meal by Grant Achatz at Alinea,
mm-hmm.
who went through, not similar, but went through a pain of his own, losing taste in his tongue. And at that meal, what was the rapport with the chef? And what was the meal that you ate? And what did it bring to light?
Well, I ate my meal at Alinea before I had the chance to interview Grant Achatz. So when I went in, it was late on a Saturday night. I was with my best friend from college, and it was just this parade of courses that were intellectually stimulating as well as delicious, or sometimes flavor challenging. And it really gave me a look into Simwin's brain, who thinks so much about the senses and how they combine when it comes to food, in terms of, you know, a sweet potato tempura on a stick of smoldering cinnamon, so you're smelling the cinnamon as you eat this hot burst of flavor, or a pillow put on the table by the server, a cloth pillow filled with lavender-scented air, with a plate on top that slowly deflates the pillow as you eat, so you're smelling as you're eating, and it combines all of these senses at once. And when I spoke with Grant Achatz the next day, he really explained to me more about his own experience and how it related to how he sees food and flavor and what it was like to rely only on the sense of smell when he couldn't taste on his tongue.
Yeah.
And it was parallel to my experience in many ways, except not at all. And I think that we both learned so much about how flavor comes together with all of our senses by losing one for however long.
Now when you cook, do you think smell first? Smell forward?
Well, I enjoy smelling as I cook more than ever before. Yeah. But I really do try and think about all of the other things that come together at the same time. I'm very attuned to texture and temperature in my food now. And I love to make things look beautiful on the plate in a way that I don't think I did before.
Yeah. So what are your favorite meals to cook now?
Oh, I don't know. I love to just go to the green market and get whatever is there and whatever's colorful and put it together in a way that looks and tastes interesting.
Yeah. Are there new smells too that you're drawn to that you weren't to before? Other than skunk, that is.
Oh, other than skunk, I like to challenge my sense of smell in terms of cooking new things or cooking old things in different ways. Just, you know, continually trying to challenge remembering scent and applying it to food in new ways.
Yeah. What were some of the more absurd smells that you, you know, got to sense, got to actually breathe in? I know being like in Tony Ma's kitchen, you must have, but being through all these other experiences, you must have smelled something that was not ordinary that stuck with you.
Not ordinary. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, like for me, like it's combinations of things, I think, more so than a singular ingredient. The first time, though, you know, it was a taste, it was also a smell. Isophon from Pierre Hermé, which is the combination of raspberry, rose, and I can't think of the other thing right now, but it just like this completely new thing that I use that as a reference point.
Right. Well, a few things come to mind. I mean, when I was in the flavor lab, the smell of jackfruit, which I had never, I've still never tasted that before, but smelling that, it was new. I think Ellie, the flavorist, described it as banana and custardy, and you know, it was really different and delicious smelling. But also at Alinea, I remember eating something that combined mustard and passion fruit. So it was like this very sharp, tangy, bitter, spicy with this very sweet, and eating at the same time, it was almost like these flavors were at war in your mouth.
Yeah. Now, was there anything you wish you ate when you didn't have a sense of smell, like durian? Just got it out of the way.
But, oh, I wish I had, actually. It would have been good to say that I've experienced that, which I haven't.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that, you know, you can smell what's cooking again.
Oh, thank you.
I didn't mean to quote The Rock. I just realized. I think I did. But the book is wonderful. Everyone should check it out. Season of Taste by Echo.
Echo.
Yeah. Please read it because it gives you a whole new appreciation, not just for smell, but for being able to taste all the senses. Molly Birnbaum, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Your host, Michael Harlan Terfillin. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. AMP goes local. The Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, commonly known as the AMP, that grocery chain you've seen all your life, has glommed onto the concept of local and sustainable and has just introduced a new consortium of producers known as the Mid-Atlantic Country Farms, from which they will source beef and poultry. The animals are antibiotic and hormone-free, raised on vegetarian feed. There is no mention of certified humane or animal welfare approved status, however. Maybe they haven't gotten that far in the marketing department. But what makes this of interest is that AMP supplies all AMP supermarkets, Pathmark, Food Emporium, Waldbaum's, and Superfresh. These are not particularly high-end supermarkets, so this is good news for the average consumer. If you want to read more about this, you can go to the AMP website, which is www.apt.com/pressroom. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Finger on the Pulse and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th, from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Milk Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexico, Kraft, Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Pewter Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.
Saturday, July 23rd, Bushwick Block Party. It's a party in the street. Free pizza by Roberta. Death Killer Death Wrestling. Featuring the legendary Mad Dog Tosto. Photo Booth by Ryan Slack. Water World. Clothes by Chimera Dactyl. Mary Meyer. Lauren Bogart. Death Killer Asphalt Resistant Jeans. All types of food for your face. Sweet Soda by P&A. Roberta's Bake Sale. Heritage Foods USA. Orange Chaney Eating Contest by the Orange Chaney Brothers. Live music by Alex Trujan. Florida Paper Twin. Gang Sign. The Netherlands. Team Robespierre. Wild Yak. MC Todd and Bo Breezy. Night Show. Yeah, yeah. Sponsored by Martin Greenfield Clothers. Free Fitness Studio. Heritage Radio Network. Free Williamsburg. 6 Point Beer. Momo's Sushi Shack. Beer Box USA. Planet of the Bates. Bushwick Block Party. It's a party in the street.
All day long.